Hegemony and legitimation. This is the hegemony part of this lecture. That's an idea which I, part of my special inventory of concepts that I think are incredibly interesting as intellectual ideas, as concepts to think about. It's a term that has a lot of political resonance. It's become a term of ideological power to use in various kinds of contexts, but it also has a very specific kind of conceptual standing, theoretically, for which there really isn't an alternative term. And I think for that reason, it's worth protecting its theoretical meaning rather than letting it just become a kind of diffuse idea. So I want to spend most of our time working around the concept of hegemony, which is not restricted to the question of ideology. So when it's connected to ideology, people talk about a hegemonic ideology or ideological hegemony. The term is broader than that, but I think its ideological focus, anchoring it in the problem of ideology, is one of its most useful and productive ways of thinking about what's really going on with this concept. So this is a case where I think we've got a lot of intellectual work to do. It's a good theoretical concept. And I do think it's worth trying to preserve and render really precise its theoretical meaning so that it doesn't just become one of these broad terms. Legitimation, on the other hand, is a very common expression. Everybody knows that. Weber talks about legitimation. It's kind of standard term. It does play an important role in Marxian accounts of ideology. I think it's a less interesting concept, not necessarily less important with respect to particular explanatory problems, but it's less interesting. It doesn't pose as deep and interesting puzzles as the problem of hegemony does. And more transparent. I don't think there's as much confusion about the concept of legitimation. So I'm going to spend less time on legitimation, which should not signal that it's a less important or relevant concept. I just think it's a less difficult one than hegemony. So we'll begin with hegemony. Sometimes hegemony is almost, so to speak, it's a way of talking about a dominant ideology with a capital D, you know, or ideological domination, but I really mean dominant, you know. So hegemony is just domination writ large. That's a common way that the term gets thrown around in discussions. I think it's better to think of hegemony as in a different way. This is a little bit like, the contrast here is a little bit like the discussion we had about the distinction between exploitation and oppression. That is, you don't want the word exploitation to become just the generic term for all nastiness that one class does to another. You want to give it precision because it's a very specific form of oppression that has consequences by virtue of it being that form. Namely, in the exploitation-oppression case, exploitation confers power on the exploited in the way that oppression doesn't. And that's the kind of key idea within exploitation, because it involves appropriating effort and people control their effort. Exploitation makes the exploiter dependent on the exploited. I mean, all of that stuff gets lost when it becomes just mushed into a generic oppression concept. Well, I think there's some of the same stuff is going on with respect to hegemony. Hegemony is deeply connected to domination, as exploitation is to oppression. But the specificity of it is what gives where all the action is. The term which I think helps clarify what's going on, and then we can work on to get a more specific meaning, is the idea of leadership, and in particular the contrast between a leader and a boss. Right, and some bosses are also leaders. That's why this is there's some confusion here. So if you just think about what it means in any particular context, to say that somebody is a leader. That is what it means for the people who do what the leader says, as opposed to somebody being a boss. So in the case of a boss, you do what you say because there are consequences for disobeying. You know, the boss has some kind of power, some kind of authority over you, gives you instructions. You may not like the instructions, but there's some kind of sanction lurking in the weeds if you don't follow them. Now, you may actually agree with the instruction. It doesn't follow that just because you're told to do something by a boss that you don't want to do it. It could be the case that you're in a work setting and the boss tells you to go get the lumber to bring it in, and you realize, yes, to do this project, the lumber has to be brought in, and the boss is the person who has the power to direct who goes and gets the lumber. I'm one of those people. I'm going to go do it. So it's not that you think that the demand on what you are being asked to do is unreasonable or stupid, but it's still the compliance is with a boss is because the boss has the authority and the power to enforce those orders. If you're in a context where the person who's giving the instructions is a leader, and that's how you feel about the person, and they make they tell you to do something, it's a more complicated process of compliance. In that case, it's because you also have trust in the person's judgment. You think they have information and knowledge that makes them in a good position to decide what to do. And above all, and this is the key to the use of the metaphor of leader with respect to the idea of hegemony, you feel that a leader is taking your needs and interests into account when telling you to do something. That the leader is not just telling you to do something because it's good for the leader. The leader is telling you to do something because it's either good for your joint enterprise, or the leader, and in some sense or other, the leader is taking what's good for you into account and telling you what to do. Think about, in endless war movies, right? The platoon, in which one kind of platoon has a boss at the top, who just orders people to do things, and another has a leader at the top. In terms of what it means for the willingness of soldiers to do things which they may not understand, they may not think it's good for them, but they trust the leader. And what that trust means, it's both a competence issue. You think the leader knows what the leader's doing. But, and I think this is the key thing, you also think the leader is not just out for himself or herself. The leader is taking your needs and interests into account in deciding what should be done. And that confidence means that you're willing to comply without the main reason for compliance being the fear of sanction. Yeah?
So is the key point then just the belief? It's the belief rather than the objective condition of whether or not the ruler is acting in the interest?
Right. So in the first instance, it's belief, but there is also an additional claim in the theory of hegemony that belief is robust when there's some truth to it. It's not just illusion. If it was entirely illusion, it would be vulnerable. That is, the stability of the belief in a leader, since it's iterated, you have many experiences of being told what to do and then you live with the consequences. If every time you're told what to do, it's harmful to you and the leader thrives, your sense that the leader actually has your interests would begin to erode.
Yeah.
So
it's, hegemony isn't based on simple.
Right. It may be aided by mystification. It may be more stable, because people will discount counter evidence more easily if it's mystification. But the robustness of hegemony, of leadership, in this general sense, we haven't specifically talked about ideological hegemony yet, but just this general sense of a leader, the robustness in the trust and confidence that the ruling authority is a leader and not just a boss, depends at least in part on the lived experience of the actors when they act under that set of beliefs. And if it's, this is again the sort of Terborn qualification and subjection, affirmations and sanctions kind of idea. If acting on the belief that the authoritative figure is a leader constantly results in actions which seem harmful to oneself and good for the leader, that will be corrosive of that belief. Daniel,
you answered my question.
Okay. I think the way then, that in the first instance, the way to think about what's going on in this hegemony versus domination contrast, just a kind of metaphor to think about it, is leadership versus being a boss. Gramsci uses the expression, a class is hegemonic when it displays moral and intellectual leadership. He uses the word leadership as a way of capturing the idea of hegemony. A ruling class is a hegemonic class, not just a ruling class, when it displays, and we have to figure out what the hell that means, moral and intellectual leadership. When the president, the general, the CEO of General Motors proclaims what's good for GM is good for America. That's a classic statement of American capitalism. What's good for GM is good for America. That is affirming the hegemonic character of the American bourgeoisie in the 1950s. What's good for GM was good for America. It wasn't, you know, he wasn't making a preposterous claim, because what's good for GM provided jobs and pensions and health care and a pretty long time horizon for workers in GM and for the communities around GM factories for quite a long period into the future when that claim was made. Now, of course, it's still a partial claim. It doesn't say what's good for GM is good for America. It doesn't mean what's best for GM is best for America, right? It may be that, yes, you want GM to thrive, but not under the conditions that the GM CEO wants it to thrive, you know, et cetera. You know, there's all sorts of asterisks you have to put on the quote to make it accurate. But it's still a statement that captures an actual truth about the way the interests and well-being of the subordinate class get hitched to the project of the dominant class, of the ruling class. So that linking of the interests of subordinate classes to the dominant class, so that the dominant class's project, that term gets used in this context, seems to be one that's inclusive rather than just exclusive. Michael Burrovoy has a very nice discussion in his work on the labor process between two kinds of factory regimes, the term he uses, a despotic regime and a hegemonic regime. So you can think of this not just in terms of the overall standing of a class and the society as a whole, but in the micro settings of class relations. A despotic factory regime is one in which workers do what they're told because of surveillance, threat of being fired, basically fear. That fear is the dominant basis for compliance. A hegemonic regime is one in which the nature of the rules of the game that get set up in the micro settings of the shop floor means that workers feel that in one way or another, their interests are served by seeing that the firm thrives in ways in which they will themselves benefit. Their interests and time horizons are anchored in the workplace. And their compliance, therefore, comes in significant ways from their own energetic consent. It doesn't mean there aren't conflicts as well, but it just means that that's a central part of why they do what they do. In a hegemonic regime, unlike in a despotic regime, a lot of the surveillance over shirking, you know, are you doing your bit, comes workers monitoring each other, rather than foreman monitoring workers. So in a hegemonic regime, you get pissed off if a fellow worker is not doing their job, their bit, right? You're saying, I'm doing my bit for the collective interest here, why are you, you know, shirking, slacking off? That's me. That's an imposition of a cost on me, not on the boss, on me. So hegemonic regimes produce horizontal monitoring. Yeah.
Does fear from the foreman and everything still factor in to varying degrees in different hegemonic?
Yes, absolutely. And I, you know, as a standard ploy in social theory, you present a binary, a dichotomy, hegemonic versus despotic. Actually, of course, there's not only gray areas, but there's always elements of both. hegemonic regimes are always backed by coercion. Indeed, that's in Gramsci's original formulation. There's a oft-stated quote from Gramsci that I don't think Gramsci ever said. It's one of these things that he should have, because it would have given you a nice slogan for his. So there's a definition of hegemony as consent backed by the armory of coercion. That's an expression. You'll find quotes. I can't find that actual quote. But the point is Gramscian, that consent is backed by coercion. And backed means keeping the rules of the game in place such that if those rules are in place, you get consent, because the rules hook together the interests of dominant and subordinate groups. But the rules themselves are disadvantageous to the subordinate group. But if you can't get out of those rules, you know, if the rules are fixed and taken for granted, then actual coercion is pretty minimal. It doesn't have to intrude very much. And that's really true in the best examples of the hegemonic factory regimes. You know, coercion was really not part of the daily life of workers in that sense of the threat of being fired. And it didn't explain a lot of their motivations for working as hard as they worked. All right, that's the kind of generic idea. Yeah?
This is essentially the same explanation as in envisioning the utopias when you talk
yeah.
about...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, as far as I know, I haven't changed my views since... Right, exactly. This is the contrast I draw in the chapter on... first chapter in the section on transformation, in the theory of reproduction, between hegemonic and despotic forms of rule. Exactly, yeah. Okay, so that's hegemony in general. Now let's turn to the more specific question of moral and intellectual leadership, which is the substance of what's meant by ideological hegemony rather than just hegemony pure and simple. Here I'm going to follow the analysis of Chantal Mouffe, which I think is extremely interesting and productive. And as far as I know, it's certainly the best account of ideology in terms of hegemony, what it means to talk about a hegemonic ideology. It's the best treatment of that problem that I know of. She elaborates this by contrasting two visions of what it means to have opposing ideologies, you know, to have an antagonism of two ideologies, ideological class struggle, proletarian and bourgeois ideology, revolutionary and reactionary ideology, socialist and capitalist ideology, whatever. What does it mean to have an antagonism of two ideologies? Two different interpretations of that idea. The first sees ideological conflict as the confrontation of two paradigmatically opposed ideologies, two systems that are antagonistic in every respect. Every element of the two systems are opposed to each other. So that socialist ideology is the negation of capitalist ideology. If capitalist ideology is in favor of individualism, socialist ideology is collectivism. If capitalist ideology is in favor of bourgeois democracy, socialist ideology is in favor of socialist democracy. If capitalism is in favor of private property, socialism is in favor of social or public or state property. On every element, you just negate the capitalist element, you get the socialist element. Two completely incommensurable ideologies that are fighting with each other. That's the first vision. Second vision is that contending ideologies contain many of the same ingredients. Many of the elements are the same in opposing ideologies. They're just packaged differently. Mouffe uses the term ideological matrix, the term matrix of ideology, to capture this idea. So you have a bunch of elements and they're connected in a matrix. That's a formal term. You can think of it as a network of concepts whose meanings are derived from their interconnection, not just from their essential content. The belief in individual freedom is an element of both bourgeois and socialist ideology. Socialists don't, in this view, reject the idea of individual freedom, but it's linked to different other concepts which give it a different inflection, a different meaning, by virtue of the matrix that connects it and how the different elements are prioritized. In bourgeois ideology, individual freedom gets tightly connected to private property as an element. Whereas in a socialist ideology, perhaps individual freedom gets tightly connected to democracy as an element. You have to figure out what's the proper articulation of elements to define the coherent form of a socialist ideology. The two ideologies can contain all the same elements, but they get hierarchized, inflected, anchored in different sets of priorities. In this view, then, ideological struggle is struggle over the matrix of ideology. It's struggle on the terrain of ideology. That's the way the language that Mouffe uses, rather than struggle between paradigmatic ideologies. Ideological struggle is about the appropriation and reappropriation of elements in new configurations. A successful ideology, a successful hegemonic ideology, is one which manages to absorb elements from oppositional ideologies and neutralize them by the form of absorption. The best example in the case of bourgeois ideology is the idea of democracy. So the idea of democracy is utterly antithetical to capitalism in terms of its core meanings. It was rejected by bourgeois ideology. Initial formulations of a pro-capitalist ideological configuration that would help to reproduce and consolidate and justify that system of property relations and class relations, democracy didn't figure at all. Freedom did, liberty, but not democracy. Democracy was a demand of the people, not a demand of the capitalist class. The capitalist class wanted rule by the property, not rule by the people. Democracy gets absorbed in the course of struggles over the 19th century, the course of the 19th and into the 20th century, and gets reconfigured within this new articulation to the point where it's now one of the central elements. American imperialism in defense of the conditions for capital accumulation is done under the banner of democracy, spreading democracy and freedom. Both go together. But nevertheless, democracy has really become an integral element of standard bourgeois ideology.
I don't quite understand how or why democracy was not originally configured into the setup of socialism. I'm thinking of the U.S. and Britain as the two main examples, because when Britain had the Industrial Revolution and arguably in the capitalist phase of production, it had already had a parliamentary system which was pseudo democratic, and then the American example as well.
Britain was capitalist for 200 years before the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution was a phase of capitalist development in Britain. And it was a rule by the gentry, which were property-owning elites. And Parliament, which dated from the Middle Ages, the initial struggle was over whether it was just nobles or property owners that would be Parliament. Now, we can call that democratic, but they didn't use the term democratic. That wasn't how they defended it. It was that the consent of the propertied classes, the king needed the consent of the propertied classes for taxation. So it was no taxation without representation, but it was just taxation of property. So the American slogan is not no rule without consent. It was no taxation without representation, right? That was a property-based notion of what accountability should be. And indeed, in the American Constitution, as originally developed, property was a basis for the franchise. You know, and unashamedly so. I mean, Tom Paine, there were people at that point arguing for a people's democracy, but that was not the prevailing view, and certainly not the view that was organically connected to capitalism. The U.S. was relatively early in getting rid of the property franchise. It might have even been the first, I'm not sure. You know, it could be that the U.S. was the earliest to get rid of the property franchise, but it was among the, it was quite a late.
When was that about?
1830s, I guess. The property franchise was disappeared, something like that.
So if one would say that capitalism did incorporate democracy, you could just say that it was democracy for the landed or for the property owners,
right,
but not for the people.
Right. And the notion of the people ruling, you know, the demos, government of the people, by the people, for the people, that was not organic to the beginning of capitalism. That is the result of decades of struggle. And in the U.S., we don't really get democracy as a universal principle to actually be enforced until the 1950s or 60s, really. You know, so we're very late compared to some other places. European countries, women got the vote here in the, you know, 1919. There are some European countries that didn't, women, European democracies, where women didn't get the vote till after World War II. So the realization of democratic values as sufficiently important to actually take seriously the notion of people as opposed to statuses, you know, took a long time. Yeah.
I was just thinking that was the basis for the Electoral College, right? The fear of an actual rule of the people.
Well, the Electoral College occurred even before there was any whiff of popular franchise. So the Electoral College was dealing with a different issue, which was federalism, basically. That is, how are we going to get a national president and maintain states' rights and state sovereignty? So the idea of the Electoral College was, as the original idea of the Senate, you know, the original idea of the Senate was that senators were chosen by state legislatures, not by the people. There was no direct election of senators until the 20th century. So the indirect appointment of senators from state legislatures was under the idea that what senators were doing is not representing voters. They were representing states. That's why there's two per state. So the U.S. Senate was not originally a popularly elected body. They represented state governments. So you had state governments, which were the primary sovereign units. They had a national government to solve certain kinds of limited problems. A president that was going to be elected by an electoral college rather than by the people, you know, by voters, but not because of a fear of the people, but because they wanted it to be more representative of states. Yeah.
So I'm still having a little trouble understanding though how they really changed how their ideology really changed. So I mean, even though they didn't use the word democracy, they certainly thought what they were doing was more democratic than the old absolutists.
More representative. It was Republican. You know, there wasn't a king. There were representatives, but of whom?
So they were putting in place institutions that would still protect them from majority rule. Right? I mean, they're afraid it was majority rule, right? So they were putting in place like parliaments and you know, vote, you know, you can only vote if you have, you're a property owner, because they're afraid of what would happen if the majority could vote, right?
There was some of that at the time when the property franchise was just taken for granted, because what was seen as the problem was how do we hold a state which has taxing authority accountable to the people who generate the wealth, which are property owners, in the view of the time.
But there were movements that were pushing for, in the French Revolution and in England too, there were these movements that, you know, like the levelers that were.
Oh, absolutely,
and they were opposed to that. So the idea was presented to them. Obviously.
Yeah, right. So there was a threat lurking in the background, of real democracy, which was universally regarded as incompatible with capitalism. Marx thought it was kind of incompatible.
It seems like that's still kind of the case today. I mean, there's still a lot of ways in which they're presented
sure.
with what the majority wants, and they have mechanisms to prevent.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't seem like they've really adopted this, you know, except, ideology or...
Well, no, but at the ideological level, the element of democracy as ruled by the people is fully absorbed into the ideology. And, you know, and then it has to be tamed. As opposed...
It's not really ruled by the people, right? It's just universal vote. It's not... I mean, the public wants lots of things, and they know they want them, and they're preventing them from happening.
They don't want rule by the people, but at the ideological level, democracy is represented as rule by the people. That's how it's represented in the United States. And then there's all these provisions that try to neutralize it institutionally, and then ideological articulations which try to neutralize the weight of that idea, try to, you know, deflect the weight of that idea. But if you ask the average American what does democracy means, they will, and say, does it mean rule by the people? They'll say, yeah, it's a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's a standard way that most people think of it. Yeah.
So in talking about how these different groups historically gained the franchise, and first the poor, and women, and racial minorities, I was just thinking about that in terms of the short piece you signed by Habermas that talks about kind of a hierarchy of justifications for legitimizing the rule of, you know, the state or the economic ruling class. So is it, I mean, I guess, can you talk about the notion, like, do you believe that the reason why these disenfranchised groups gain the franchise is because the state needed more to legitimate itself? Like what was the actual reason that it gave in, you know?
Well, in some context, they gave in because the disruptive capacity of the struggles was costly.
Could have served to delegitimate them.
Yeah, you know, the challenges were costly. There were people who came to understand that expanding the franchise was a way of co-opting and incorporating struggles, taming it. That was seen as risky, though. Before it happened, people didn't know exactly how it would work. Marx certainly thought the universal franchise was a risky proposition for the ruling class, not a foregone conclusion that that would be a successful way of incorporating people. You know, in different contexts, the expansion of the franchise and the deepening of democracy occurs under different kinds of reasons. The destruction of Jim Crow, the exclusion of blacks from voting in the South, and their relative marginalization in the North politically. That occurred under a context of intensified struggle, a destruction of the economic basis for their political exclusion, so it was less crucial for the Southern economy that you have black disenfranchisement, and then a changed geopolitical situation of the United States, which meant that maintaining such manifestly racist state institutions was geopolitically harmful, you know, because of the Cold War and so on. So those all those came together to make the destruction of the Southern racial state possible in the 50s and 60s, where it hadn't been in the 20s.
So can we say that the main driving reason behind enfranchisement of varying groups is the need for the state to continue to be perceived as legitimate?
I'm just hesitating on the word "the main" because I,
right.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to make it as that sweeping and transhistorical generalization. It is certainly the need for legitimacy in the face of challenges which are threatening legitimacy, but there's also practical disruption that's occurring. You know, in these struggles and
safety concern, right?
Yeah, and the. And then the,
Well, and relevant to this discussion, there's hegemony that's occurring. This is what Gramsci would argue, is that part of why you get these concessions in terms of the vote or democracy is that you have an elite that can't by itself, without aligning with other classes, basically run society. So they make real compromises, material, process-wise, that allow them to gather enough support among potentially aligned classes to be the ruling class.
And classes can rule with weak hegemony, but it's then costly. It requires a lot of despotism. That is, the alternative to a hegemonic rule is a despotic rule, again, polarizing this in a more extreme way. But despotism is costly. So despotism has tendencies towards irrationality. It's hard to have really fine-tuned despotism, so lots of debates and ideas and problem-solving efforts get hurt by virtue of a generally despotic regime. This is a problem that China faces today, for example. But there's lots of just practical problem solving that has to go on in a complex economy that's becoming ever more complex. You've got problems of externalities, you've got problems of pollution, how to balance the trade-offs. All these things require detailed problem solving capacity. And to do that in an environment where there isn't free debate and a free flow of ideas and people disagreeing and, you know, changing their minds without having that kind of free-floating debate, it's hard to come up with good solutions. But it's hard to have free-floating debate that you just confine to technical questions. You know, if you create the apparatus of despotic censorship, it's very difficult to fine-tune that and to create a spirit of open debate. So this kind of issue affects things like how the educational system is organized and the extent to which people develop the right habits, bourgeoisian habitus, of freewheeling debate as opposed to rote learning. So if you're subjected to rote learning throughout your schooling because that's safe, and then you're called upon to engage in freewheeling debate to solve problems, you're not good at it, right? So there's this kind of stereotyped view that the United States, for all of its flaws in its educational system, does promote pretty wild freewheeling debate as a kind of style of, you know, learning how to think and to act. And so even if students don't know a lot, they know how to argue. Right, so there is this view, this is a bit of a digression from the main thrust here, but there is this view about American education that there's actually an advantage of the looseness of our high school education, which means that in terms of scientific knowledge and math knowledge and history knowledge, by the time that students graduate from high school, they don't know as much as their European counterparts. But by the time they graduate from college, they do. Right? So that university fills up these deficits. But they enter college raring to go to argue with people, to write term papers where their ideas are on the page rather than just reporting what the readings say. That on average American students, from the better high, I'm not talking about people who go to a totally crappy school that doesn't even teach that, but they've developed a quality of engagement and thinking which is less cabined within a model of memorizing what you're taught and reporting it back to the professor or to the teacher. So that, I think it's easy to overstate this contrast with Europeans, but there's a bit of that. Anyway, this is just with respect to the despotism versus hegemony. A hegemonic system is able to tolerate that kind of freewheeling stuff in a way that a despotic system finds it really tough. And then to draw the line, the fantasy of despotism is that you would just repress the threatening elements and let everything else be freewheeling. And there's a little bit, part of what's loosened up in China is precisely that. You know, there is, when I've lectured in China, in the closed room of a seminar room, you know, where nobody was recording anything, people were very freewheeling. You know, much more lively debate and discussion than you'd ever see in a Chinese newspaper about ideas, about politics, about issues. People would be very critical of the regime in the space of a seminar room. And what people generally said is, as long as they don't write it down, you know, even if there's some agent of the government in the room, as long as you don't write it down or broadcast it, you can pretty much say what you want in a university. But still, it's hard to cabin these things. And that's why a hegemonic rule is a desirable form of rule. But hegemonic rule also requires compromises. It's not costless as well. So there is a kind of tension and trade-off between a hegemonic rule which requires that ruling classes make concessions that meaningfully address in one way or another the interests of subordinate classes, incorporate their elements ideologically, make material concessions on the one hand, and on the other hand, despotic rule which is rigid, which stifles problem solving, but which doesn't require the same degree of concessions. Let me go on with the moral and, yeah.
I was just thinking, in order for a hegemonic, say, government to function, doesn't it have to incorporate some elements of despotism in the sense that we pay our taxes because we know that they're going to go to build roads and fund our troops, that kind of stuff, but there's also the IRS, and if we don't pay our taxes, you know, there's consequences.
So here's the thing, let me just use the tax example, and then we'll get back to the ideological aspect. There's a very nice book on taxation, on basically asking the question, why do people pay taxes, by Margaret Levy, L-E-V-Y, very good political scientist. She calls she describes taxation as what she calls quasi-voluntary compliance. Right? So you can imagine, again, to use another one of these stylized contrasts, two tax regimes. Regime number one, you only pay taxes because of fear that you're going to be caught and punished. Tax regime number two, you feel some moral obligation to pay taxes as a civic duty. I'm a member of a system. I don't want to be a free rider on other people's payments. It's an obligation. I have an obligation as a responsible person. So people pay taxes for the same reason they vote in elections. People don't vote in elections because of the belief that one vote is going to decide who's elected president. That's irrational. People vote for president elections because they feel they're a citizen, and that's a responsible thing you do as a citizen because you want the president to be elected as opposed to a king, and the only way presidents can be elected is if people vote, and I'm a person, and therefore I have an obligation to vote. So people vote out of civic duty. Now, the quasi-voluntary compliance is this. This is why this is an assurance game, to use the kind of game theory language. I'm prepared to pay my taxes as a citizen because it's the responsible thing to do, so long as I believe other people are paying their taxes. Because I don't want to be a sucker. You know, a sucker is somebody who pays their taxes even if nobody else does. You know, nobody else is paying the taxes. I'm not going to pay my taxes. But if I'm pretty confident that most other people are paying taxes, then I'll pay my taxes. Now, here's where the coercion comes in. There are some scallywags in the population. Some percentage of people will not pay their taxes unless they're afraid. So they're scoundrels. We know that. Let us suppose that 25% of taxpayers will only pay taxes under the threat of coercion. And 75% will pay taxes so long as they believe that 80% of people pay taxes. Right? That's the threshold. 80% is the threshold at which you feel, yes, enough people are paying taxes that triggers my civic obligation. Now, if there's no coercion in the system, 25% don't pay taxes, and then the other 75% don't because you don't cross the 80% threshold. So in the absence of coercion, the civic responsibility dies. If you have enough coercion to assure that 5% of, you know, there's that 25% of scoundrels that a fifth of them, 5% of the population, pay their taxes out of fear, then you cross the 80% threshold and you get 80% of the population paying their taxes. So that's the role of coercion. The role of coercion is to sanction the would-be free riders, the cheaters, to signal publicly that the state is serious about cheating, which then gives confidence to the non-cheaters who wouldn't want to cheat, that they shouldn't cheat because there's civic responsibility. This is one of the reasons why underfunding the IRS's enforcement mechanisms, which has happened over the last 30 years, leads to a degradation of tax compliance. It's not because more people want to cheat, that is, that's their first preference. It's that people's confidence in the integrity of the system goes down, and therefore they're less willing to pay their taxes. So enforcement serves the purpose of undercutting, of punishing the free riders and therefore triggering the cooperators. There's lots of other contexts where this kind of dialectic, you know, between coercion and consent occurs. Think about littering. If you have a beach which has no litter on it, and you're the kind of person that doesn't habitually litter, you won't litter. You know, you'll see this as a pristine beach. You have your coffee cup. You've finished your cup of coffee. You're not going to just throw it on the beach. If there's a bit of litter there already, it's not looking so great, you might. Right? So the degree of littering on the beach can trigger bad behavior on more people. So the litter increases. And then even a person who never litters, sees this as just a trash heap of a beach, will start littering. So different people have different trigger points for when they take the amount of refuse in an area as a signal that this is not an area that people respect and that they keep up. It's not the kind of place where you shouldn't litter. It's one reason why spending a little bit of money on having somebody every day come at the end of the day and clean up the stuff on a beach means that there's a hell of a lot less to clean up. If you don't clean it up at the end of every day, it's not just that each day you get the same amount, you start getting much more litter. And that's because of this interface between irresponsible people who just don't give a shit and will litter wherever, and responsible people who don't want to litter, except if they're in a environment which says this is a trash heap, you don't have to worry about it. And that's, you know, and this is a point, this is the kind of point, this is now just a kind of methodological point. This is the kind of issue which I think has been enormously clarified by game theory. You know, and the most sophisticated models then have a population that's heterogeneous on their preferences. Different people have different thresholds. And you can get cascades in which a well-ordered community rapidly deteriorates. You can get cascades because of when you hit the trigger points for people just saying, aha, this is a neglected place, we don't have to worry about it anymore. Or you can have very robust environments where it would take a lot of litter on the beach to get most people to start littering. And depending on where those thresholds are, it can be expensive or cheap to stay below that threshold, because once a week cleanup might do it, or you need somebody constantly there to pick up. Okay, this is,
Can I just ask what the title of the book was, Levy's book?
It's called,
Alright, I'll just look for taxation order.
I don't know if taxation's in the title. It might have one of these. If during the break, if somebody has an internet connection here, I can find you that. Get to the title of it. It's a good book. All right. So moral and intellectual leadership. What this means is a class has moral and intellectual leadership if it's able to construct an hegemonic ideology rather than just a dominant ideology, not an ideology that's to be explained mainly by being crammed down people's throats, but an ideology that works. And it works as in this leadership model if it's capable of incorporating oppositional elements and integrating them into a configuration. An ideological struggle then means a battle between over the articulation and re-articulation of these elements. Now, to illustrate this, I think it would be kind of useful to just think through what are the elements. You know, so what do you think are the, what would you say are the kind of conventional elements of bourgeois ideology? That's not going to work. I don't know if any of these are going to work. Let's see. Yeah. So here's bourgeois ideology. So what would you say are the, what elements are we sticking here?
Individual rights.
So we got individual rights,
property rights, public rights,
property, other things,
representation,
I'm talking about contemporary, so representation, but also democracy. Let's put those together, because democracy is certainly an element of the...
The idea that economic growth is all that's needed for total social well-being.
So let's just, as an element, as a general element, let's say, I would... How about prosperity?
Economic prosperity.
Yeah, economic. Okay. Put the word economic.
Laissez-faire.
Laissez-faire is a particular policy prescription for how you should. I'm talking about the kind of core values. These are all
public-private division.
Sure.
This might go with some of the other ones, but a general notion of free choice.
So let's just, how about calling using freedom as the, the kind of generic. The generic term. And, you know, there's others. There's obviously other things we could add. I had equality, because there is a certain notion of equality. It's equality of opportunity, for example. So we can add equality of rights, equal rights, equality of opportunity. So there is a kind of equality that's kind of bound up with here. So there's individual rights and an equality notion here. But we could put equality, you know, as a general idea that gets configured. Now, what do we? So this is a list of elements. Now, what do we mean by the bourgeois articulation? So one of the things it would mean, it would be looking down this list and deciding what are the values or ideas that discipline the scope of other ideas. And so some of these have a privileged status, and so when there's conflicts between them, they have what philosophers would call lexical priority. That is, they preempt the range of variation of the other that would violate it. So one clear aspect of that is that the democracy component is disciplined by other components. It's not a primary disciplining element. It's not an element which says, by God, we have to preserve democracy, and if some shaving of private property rights is necessary to really get democracy, so be it. Democracy trumps private property as a value. Yeah. That's not the way bourgeois ideology would articulate these two. Right? So if you're thinking about ideological struggle, whoops. I wonder who that would be. People know I'm... I don't know if she didn't know. So democracy is present for both bourgeois and socialist ideology. I think we can say, let's put private... Well, property and private property. That's present in both. That is, a socialist doesn't have to say that people can't own their own bicycles, you know, that you can't own your own house. There's private property. You know, one idea of socialism is that it's a negation of private property. No, there's private property in socialism. In some socialisms, like mine, there's even possible space for private property in the means of production. You can have some role for that. But in its articulation here, in trying to think about how are these two things connected, how is democracy and private property connected? In a socialist articulation, it's unambiguous. Democracy trumps private property. When they come into conflict, and indeed, when they come into conflict is the whole guts of the socialist element. That's what is decisive. Private property is fine so long as it doesn't undermine rule of the people. And when it's given free rein, as in capitalism, it does. So, in a bourgeois ideology, private property puts limits on democracy. In socialist ideology, democracy puts limits on private property. Yeah.
Would you say that private property places limits on equality within a capitalist society?
Sure.
Or would you say that they just redefine, that they just have a different definition?
Well, You know, sometimes, you know, you have to really think it through. Is there, do any of these terms have such strong standalone meanings that they can be really defined independently of how they're connected to others? Or is what looks like a standalone meaning just sneaking in its connection to other elements through the back door? So take equality. We can have one notion of equality, which is just the straight equality of opportunity. Another notion of equality is equal rights before the law.
Right.
And the third notion of equality is equal access to the means to live a flourishing life. Mm-hmm. Right, you know, that's this. And a fourth would be just equal well-being. I mean, I think that's an incoherent meaning, because I don't think there's any conceivable way that equal well-being can actually be anything other than a kind of, you know, fantasy desire. It's not a practical value, because there's too many things that have nothing to do with society, with social institutions, with social relations, which affect well-being. But equal access to the conditions to flourish, I think, is something that we can see as a social property. Okay, so those are different meanings, but they actually get their meaning. What you can define it, the equality one, that way, but it really has to do with how these are connected to other other elements, I think. That's what at least I think enriches what those variables mean. But it could be, you know, it's not, I wouldn't be rigid about this. Sometimes words mask meanings rather than. So it could be that there's really two concepts in play here, just under the same rubric. I think the bourgeois concept of democracy as and the socialist concept as defined independently of its connection to these other terms are not all that different now. I mean, they were when it was democracy only meant, it only meant in its very meaning representation of property. But I think now it means representation of people. And it doesn't mean that the people should control the government. But its articulation to private property means that's subject to the constraint that it can't violate the fundamental rules of private property. So that's a side condition that constrains the operation of democracy, which then, of course, ultimately changes its meaning. You know, so it's the change in the actual substance of what democracy means gets affected by its articulation to other elements. So then what, if you accept this way of doing it, then part of the task of an ideological struggle is to really sort out what these different terms mean in their articulation to other terms within one ideological configuration, and then to figure out how to challenge that with respect to an alternative, as opposed to simply reject altogether the elements. I also think this as a kind of way of thinking about the problem of transforming ideology is one that has a much more compelling force in the way you would actually talk to people about it. It's much better to talk to, if you're talking just an ordinary person who believes both in private property and democracy, it's easier to persuade them that there are circumstances in which private property cripples democracy. And really, is which of these is more important to you? Is it more important that private property have absolute sanctity, regardless of how harmful it is to other people and how much it blocks our ability to collectively shape our own destinies? Well, when you really look at it that way, people say, no, I think rule by the people is really a more important value. And on those unfortunate cases where they come into conflict with private property shouldn't be absolute. So the libertarians' view that private property has an absolute standing and can fully block the collective determination of solutions to problems is something which, when most people think about it, they don't feel comfortable with. That the bourgeois articulation of democracy and private property is not one that resonates when it's fully explained. Now, mostly it's not, of course. People just take these things for granted. The way I would articulate these, this is just sort of my sketch of how you would do it. If we take five, I've only listed five elements in my notes: freedom, democracy, private property, equality, and material well-being. So prosperity understood in that sense. material standards of living. Those, consider those five values. In the pro-capitalist articulation, freedom means freedom from coercion by the state, and this implies the sanctity of private property. So the freedom and democracy and private property triad get articulated as freedom is freedom from coercion and is based on private property. Democracy also depends on private property, because if private property is threatened, then ultimately democracy will crumble. This is Milton Friedman's view, that you cannot have a sustainable democracy without strong private property. It's an illusion, because if you get rid of strong private property, then the state is going to become authoritarian, that the democratic foundation of the state requires private property. So a state that protects freedom will ensure private property, which enables it to remain democratic. Right? So that's a complicated set of articulations. It has arguments, it has causal arguments combined with normative arguments. democratic constraints on private property are an affront to freedom. That's another articulation. So if democracy attacks private property, this is a degradation of freedom. That's part of the bourgeois articulation. Equality means equality of citizenship rights. Equality means, so equality and rights are closely connected, not equality and conditions. And material well-being is maximized by freedom plus private property. That's a not a normative claim, that's a causal claim. So bound up with these ideological elements, all of these elements are values, right? So freedom, democracy, private property, equality, and material well-being, these all are things that are valuable. People say, yes, these are goods. But their articulation depends upon causal theories about how they affect each other. And that's why hegemony and mystification are connected. The socialist rearticulation I would describe this way. True democracy depends upon equality. I wrote here equality of material well-being. That's too crude a statement. It's really equality of access to the means to live a flourishing life. But true democracy depends upon rough equality of material conditions. Freedom means freedom to do things, not just freedom from coercion. Equality is of both rights and of conditions. And democracy should constrain private property in order to enhance freedom. So the enhancement of freedom requires democracy to significantly constrain private property, because the unconstrained use of private property is an affront to freedom, not an affirmation of freedom. Okay, so that's the kind of socialist rearticulation of the same elements, you know, roughly, in just a kind of sketch. All right, it's a quarter after. I think we should take our break. Let's reconvene as close to 20 after, as that's only 6 minutes, but so 27 after. I mean, 22 after. I have to leave slightly early. There's a faculty meeting to decide on some job candidates that starts supposed to start promptly at 12, and I have strong views on these matters, as you might imagine. So I want to be sure to be there. So I think we'll wrap up. You know, between a quarter till and 10 till. Okay. So the argument that I've just given about freedom, equality, democracy, etc., these are around what Gramsci would call moral leadership, right? Because these are values. Those terms are values. Democracy is a value. Freedom is a value. Bourgeois, the capitalist class, is able to show leadership if the ideology associated with capitalism is able to incorporate the values that people hold as important, even if those values seem dissonant with capitalism. So the capacity to absorb the value of democracy into the configuration of values that constitute pro-capitalist ideology is a sign of moral leadership, meaning normative, you know, value-based leadership. Intellectual leadership has the same kind of idea, that is, you want to incorporate the ordinary lived experience of people somehow or other to make how they make sense of the world into your ideology. Ideologies are not just ideologies about values, they're also ideologies that incorporate people's explanations and understandings. And the way that I laid out those articulations combined both of those. So some of the key articulations of elements introduce intellectual content, explanations about how the world works, in order to cement the hierarchy of values. So if prosperity is maximized by freedom plus private property, prosperity is a value people care about, freedom and private property are also values in their own right. If you can show that those two values that you care about, freedom and private property, also support and strengthen this other value, prosperity, that you care about, that helps to consolidate that configuration. So the intellectual leadership comes from being able to make persuasive arguments about the connections between these elements in explanatory ways. That's what effective propaganda does. Effective propaganda integrates the common sense understandings of people into ideologies by articulating them in ways that connect to these values. Now, I've made it seem like this is all very neat, and it's not, of course. It's very messy. There's lots of inconsistencies. It just has to be good enough, really, to have a robust character. One of the implications, then, of all this is about the nature of ideological struggle, which I've already mentioned. The language to use, I think, for this is to see ideological struggle as a struggle over counter-hegemony. Hegemony is moral and intellectual leadership of dominant groups. Counter-hegemony is an attempt to forge moral and intellectual leadership of subordinate groups in their capacity to challenge. This turns out to be a pretty tricky matter, and it's not, one may say, yes, you should have a counter-hegemonic strategy. It's not always clear how you could possibly achieve a counter-hegemonic strategy, what it would take to succeed in forging an alternative to hegemony. And the problem here is very much like the problem we looked at when we studied Shavorsky's view of the dilemmas that socialist parties faced in engaging in competitive elections. That is, the choices that you face in these kinds of struggles are often risking absorption versus risking marginalization. So the effort to re-articulate the elements, that is to enter the terrain of bourgeois ideology and take its elements and try to re-articulate them, also involves validating those elements. You know, private property is given positive status. You're saying, yes, we have to re-articulate it rather than reject it. Hegemony creates a context in which radical militant resistance, where you attack the whole ideological structure, is likely to produce marginalization. The marginalization is then often reinforced by the active responses of oppositional forces. Because they are afraid of being integrated and co-opted, they polemically attack the whole matrix, the whole configuration, not just, including the elements. And this has been a constant problem, I think, on the left. Particularly what's sometimes thought of as the sectarian left attacks bourgeois ideology by attacking notions like equality of rights, like individual freedom. These are seen as bourgeois ideas. We must attack the notion of freedom individual freedom, liberty, these are bourgeois ideas. We can't embrace them and try to reconfigure them. We have to attack them. And this has the effect of marginalization. However, if you embrace individual freedom as a value, then it seems that you're buying into the bourgeois paradigm itself. It's not, therefore, obvious how to go about navigating this successfully. And this is, this is just the reality of, I think, the terrain of ideology, just like it was the reality of the terrain of politics. I'm being repetitive here. The simple solution of opposition to the system to be completely rejectionist risks marginalization. The more complex solution to enter onto the terrain of ideology and fight for its rearticulation risks being absorbed. The women's movement, I think, feminism has faced this problem. The incorporation into dominant patriarchal ideologies or dominant gender ideologies of elements from feminism, interior to those ideologies, has acted as a kind of neutralizing quality. I had a grad student who did her master's thesis on the incorporation of feminist symbols into mainstream advertising. Right, so there was one of the most notorious was the advertisement for Virginia Slims cigarettes, in which the slogan was "You've come a long way, baby," and they would show women, professional women, in kind of empowered settings, smoking Virginia Slims cigarettes with "You've come a long way, baby." There was another set of ads that Cynthia Costello, the student who wrote this master's thesis, had. This was in the early 80s. There were some ads that showed a woman executive at a business meeting surrounded by admiring men. And she was very glamorously, dressed with a lot of cleavage on her, and they were all kind of looking down her dress. It was really grotesque. But the slogan, I don't remember what the caption was, but it was basically about when you've made it to the top, you need to X, whatever, buy X or whatever it was. Well, this is just, the point was, the problem with counter-hegemonic strategies, with putting your symbols out to the world and pushing for alternative values, is that they can easily get absorbed onto the terrain of the existing hegemonic views and then neutralized. It's whether or not you can successfully fracture a hegemonic ideology, let alone a hegemonic rule more generally, whether or not you can successfully fracture it and produce counter-hegemonic possibilities, it's not just a question of how hard you try and your imagination. It's really a question of conditions under which the leadership capacity is actually being threatened by the contradictions of the world, which then makes it vulnerable to that transformation. And, arguably we are in a period. This is a period in which the practical foundations of the hegemony, being able to convincingly over time tell people, yes, your interests are all effectively hitched to the fate and project and leadership of capital. We're in a period where that's clearly been questioned and is on less secure foundations. Part of the hysteria of the right wing and its strident denunciation form of propaganda reflects their insecurity. You don't engage in that kind of rhetoric when you feel everything is going along fine and people just simply accept your views. The degree of intensity, which is unprecedented in my lifetime, of the hysterical right being in the mainstream of conservative politics, I think reflects the shakiness of the leadership capacity. It's not an affirmation of hegemony. It reflects a decline of hegemony. But whether or not a counter-hegemonic project can be forged under these conditions is another question. It's whether or not there's a credible case for the possibility of building an alternative ideological structure that would have a compelling character that would then be combined with a project of transformation so that it's seen as having practical value, not just a kind of moral value. Let me just briefly turn to the question of legitimation as a connected but distinct issue of ideology. Legitimation is basically the aspect of ideology that corresponds to Terborn's question, what is good? there's two interconnected issues around legitimation. How is the legitimation dimension connected to other aspects of ideology? Remember, Terborn has the three questions, what is good, what is possible, what exists? And how should we understand the process by which particular normative structures are produced and reproduced? Why do people accept them? Why do people answer the question, what is good, the way they do? Some of this we've already discussed in earlier discussions and in the discussion just now about hegemony, since a lot of the discussion around hegemony had to do with the articulation of different aspects of what is, different views about what is good, that is, about values. Let me just make a couple of additional points. First has to do with the connection between legitimation and mystification. So remember, mystification has to do with the distortions of how the world works, distortions of reality that mask reality. Legitimation has to do with views about what's good, right? How should we think of their connection? I think there's the two bullet points here give you two quick little encapsulated ways of understanding this. Mystifications reinforce legitimation, and legitimation obstructs demystification. That's the way I would kind of describe it. A mystification supports or reinforces legitimation. The belief that the United States is a just and good society, that's a normative judgment, right? That this is a good society, it's a just society, is related to the belief that there is in fact opportunity for advancement and that failures to advance in life are the result of individual faults. So the view that there's plenty of opportunity in American society and if you don't succeed, it's your fault, those are mystifications because those are beliefs about how the world works. But that underscores and helps to reinforce the legitimacy of the system, the beliefs that it's good, these institutions are desirable, is reinforced by the mystifications.
Well, that would only be mystification if that was not true.
Right. Mystifications are always distortions.
Right.
Yes, so it's true. I mean, I'm making a scientific claim. That is, when I claim that the belief that there's sufficient opportunity to advance that's widespread enough in the United States that failure to advance should be largely attributed to properties of individuals, that diagnosis is what is what enables me to say that the beliefs are mystifications. But my diagnosis depends upon my sociology, you know, the kind of knowledge which I believe is robust given the available evidence. Legitimation also, however, obstructs demystification. Remember that the key problem around mystification, the way I framed it, is we should think of mystification not mainly in the functionalist language that the system produces the necessary mystifications to render it stable. That would be the kind of functionalist logic. But rather, institutions are in place which make it hard to demystify. We should focus on why is it so hard to get rid of these false beliefs. In the early modern period, it was really hard to get rid of false beliefs about the heavens, about the relationship between the earth and the sun. because you got burned at the stake if you tried to eliminate those false beliefs. Our ability to challenge false beliefs about capitalism are not as difficult as those faced by Galileo, but nevertheless we face very severe difficulties because of the way media are controlled and the forms of power that regulate the kinds of messages that people get. So there's obstructions to the ability to demystify. Well, here the point is that legitimation obstructs demystifications. Beliefs in the American way, in individualism, in competitiveness and manliness, I mean, all these kinds of beliefs around values become obstacles to people seeing the real determinations at work in social life. What is often called socialization or indoctrination centers on buttressing the normative ideological supports of the existing society, which in turn act as blocks to struggles against demystification. So if your belief that it's desirable for people to be intensely competitive and individualistic, you believe this is a good thing, you value aggressive competitiveness, that helps to support your perceptions of outcomes, that people who succeed factually do so because they're good competitors. You know, the normative beliefs buttress the perception of how the world works and makes it harder to convince people that the world doesn't actually work that way. let's look at a specific example here. I think one that is pretty central to the normative structure of capitalism. The legitimation issue is bound up with individualistic competitiveness. So take the joining together of competition. People think competition's a good thing. You know, if you just ask people in general in the United States, is it good to compete? Yes. Simple answer. And is it good to be individualistic in your competition, to try to be better than other people? Is that a good or bad thing, to try to be better than others? Most people would say, yes, sure, it's good to try to be better than other people. Okay, so I think there's three values that are bound up with this idea of competitive individualism. First is, it is a good thing to compete with others to try to be better than others. That's not reprehensible. It's not a bad thing to do. And that's not true in all cultures. There are cultures that say, no, you shouldn't try to be better than anyone else. It's fine to try to improve yourself, but the motive for it should not be to be better than anyone else. There's no value in being superior. There's value in realizing your own potentials, but there's no value in being superior to others. And indeed, there's some harm in being superior to others because you might make other people feel inferior to you, and that's a bad thing. So there's this, it may be apocryphal, but there's a classic story of the Hopi community in the American Southwest. The Hopi Indians are one particular community of Native Americans, and according to the anthropological literature, they don't have a positive value for competition. And so when Hopi children are engaged in athletic competition, those that are especially good at running, when they get close to the finish line, slow up so that everybody finishes pretty much at the same time. And it's very tough to get them to try to win, because winning is seen as a break of solidarity with your fellow kids. So you want everybody to improve your running, so you'll run faster as a kind of rabbit, you know, the rabbit in the dog race, to get everybody else to run faster, but then you'll pull up at the end. Right? Now, it's a really interesting behavior, I think, in terms of my values as to, I'm bourgeois enough that I like competition and, you know, I don't run, but if I did, I would. But I really appreciate the sensibility that's involved with engaging in a race in such a way as to encourage everybody to improve their capacities, but then to pull back from the moment at which it would constitute a differentiation in in the standing of the different participants. Okay, we as a culture, and certainly it's an important part of the normative foundations of competitive individualism, that it's great to compete with others, and there's nothing wrong with trying to be better than everybody else. Certainly nothing wrong, and that's a slightly weaker version, as opposed to saying it's great to try to be better than others. People might shy away. That sounds a little creepy, but I think it's still part of the value here. Second, one's worth or status is defined by how well one measures up against other people's performance. Your own sense of self-esteem and how successful you are is measured by your relative success to others, rather than simply about how well you're doing, how much you're actualizing your own potentials, how much you've improved. All of those things have some relevance, but the bottom line of your status in the world is, how do you measure up against others? And thirdly, rewards that come from individual competition, that is, if you benefit from it, if you get ancillary rewards, not just the intrinsic reward of being better by virtue of having done better, but if you get additional rewards, contracts, endorsements, prize money, good jobs. Rewards that come from being successful in individual competition are themselves justified. So that's a second order normative belief, which doesn't logically follow. It's not an inherent consequence. So there are people, I think it's one move in the kind of socialist reconfiguration, which doesn't see a problem in competition and individuals winning in competition. The problem is all that there's ancillary rewards that get connected to it, and that's the problem. You shouldn't get higher income because you're better, but it's fine to be motivated to be better than other people. It's just that you shouldn't get rewards beyond the inherent reward in that relationship itself. Okay, so these are three elements. Let's just take this as given. They all contribute to legitimizing capitalism. One can say capitalism is a system which...
Wait, I'm sorry, what was the third element you had?
That, so...
competition is not bad, rewards are justified.
The middle one is that your status in the world depends upon how well you measure against other people's performance, not just how much you actualize your own potential. And the third is that additional rewards that come up, that are the consequence of being better than others, are themselves justified. These are three sets of beliefs. The package of these three, I think, constitutes what we would call competitive individualism, and it serves as one of the core legitimations, moral legitimations of capitalism. This is apart from whether capitalism delivers the goods, whether it's efficient, and all that stuff. These are just saying capitalism is a system that's good at realizing these values. All right? Now, the question is, why do people believe this? How do we explain the prevalence of this norm in the subjective structures of people? So the first claim here is that people actually do believe these, that this is actually part of the subjectivity of people, that thinking of ideology as the formation of this human subject, subjected to and qualified, et cetera, the sort of Terbornian perspective on this. I'm making an empirical claim that people, in fact, indeed, in general, in capitalist societies, hold some version of these values, of these normative principles. I think that's a reasonable first approximation. I would just add as a kind of asterisk that they also hold the contradictory values. People also believe that solidarity is a good thing. They also believe that it's how you play the game, not whether you win or lose, that's the important thing. They also believe that intrinsic satisfaction should matter more than beating other people. All those beliefs are also held. So it's like people hold conflicting and contradictory beliefs. These are the ones, though, that are supportive of capitalism. Now the question is, how do we explain why people hold these beliefs so broadly? What's the explanation? I think there are four different explanations. They all are present. I'm not saying these are alternatives. Think of these as four different sorts of mechanisms that are in play. First, there's simple indoctrination socialization. children are taught through role models, television, schools, hero worship, that competitive individualism is an ideal to aspire to. We were, before the class began, talking about Sunday's football games and the names of specific people who had done heroic deeds in the winning of games that were otherwise to be lost were invoked in the casual guy discussion before the class. And that is all embodying these values. It's and we're all socialized into exploring and enjoying a sport for this reason. Sports play an important role, I think, in inculcating these particular values in the fantasy life of children and in the fantasy life of adults as well. So we can call that the indoctrination model. Certainly it's a valid part of the process. Secondly, there is a set of mechanisms which we'll be exploring a little bit in the next lecture that are psychological mechanisms, especially in cognitive psychology, one of which is cognitive dissonance. So cognitive dissonance say that people adjust their values to what's possible. They don't like dissonance. So to have as a value that cooperation and valuing the success of others, trying to have everybody do as good a job as possible, that those values are constantly thwarted by the world in which we live. And so there'll be a tendency for people, since they can't change the world very well, to change their values. That values that are in conflict with the world that you experience will tend to get pushed to the side. Not, I would say, dropped altogether, but they become shadow values. That the values which are most congruent with what's possible become the values that are most operative. And cognitive dissonance is one of the mechanisms involved with that. A third kind of mechanism centers around personality rather than just indoctrination. This has to do with what could be called character structure. This is what psychoanalysts have emphasized, that it's not so much the inculcation of the belief, but the creation of a particular kind of personality which underpins those beliefs. So norms are stable and structured and are held actively because they correspond to underlying personality dispositions. This played a very important role, for example, in the analysis of fascism in the post-World War II analysis of fascism developed the notion of the authoritarian personality. The idea was that there was a certain kind of personality called the authoritarian personality that was the consequence of harsh and disciplined upbringing, where children were constantly disciplined to behave in particular ways, in which what they learned is not to behave in those particular ways. That wasn't the important thing. What they learned is to be obedient and to fear authority, and they learned it in their bones. You know, it became part of their personality to be somebody, a person that was disposed to seek an authority figure to tell them what to do, because that's what made them feel at home in the world. That's what made them feel at ease in their relationship to others, is to be bossed around by an authoritative leader who never showed any doubts. And the strict disciplinarian father was seen as the kind of source of that in the early child rearing. Well, the particular formulation by the Frankfurt School and others around the authoritarian personalities, you know, it's one theory about the formation of such personality, but it's still part of this notion of one possible explanation for why certain values are stable is because they're not stable just by being the beliefs themselves being transmitted through indoctrination, but by the character, underlying character structure of a person being created to articulate to those beliefs.
I was going to say that sounded like indoctrination and socialization.
Right. So, the extreme version in the psychoanalytic case is severe toilet training makes you a fascist when you're an adult. You know, that was that kind of, that's a caricature. It's a caricature of an argument that was actually made, you know, because of its sort of Freudian side. But that would be the kind of argument. Severe toilet, you know, deeply reprimanding and humiliating a child for difficulties in toilet training, and forcing them to behave properly through that coercive means has nothing itself to do with the content of fascism as an ideology about what's good in the world. But you're nevertheless forging a sense of emotional dispositions and character dispositions that makes those later beliefs congenial. So that's the third. So the first was indoctrination of the content. The second was cognitive dissonance. The third is character structure. And the fourth, there are social practices. That is, competitive individualism is reproduced as a norm because of the material practices of everyday life constantly validate it, make it adaptive for individuals, and punish people who violate those norms. This is the Terborn perspective, but it's basically the practical affirmations and sanctions in everyday life that reinforce or undermine particular norms about what the best way to live. I have to run. I'm already going to be a little late. We'll wrap up. There's one more little topic in this, and we'll have some kind of pastiche of remaining themes in the last lecture on Wednesday.